What would life be like
if you couldn't read?
And maybe some of you have experienced that for a while in your life. Maybe you became readers later on. I remember a time when I couldn't read. I really can't remember what that was like. But I remember as a small child, those first few days of first grade, and how anxious I was to read because I love stories already. My mom told me a lot of stories. Anybody that I could get to read me a story I was under their spell. And here's the opportunity to finally read. I remember those first days of first grade. And I think we had rod and staff at that point. And the first lesson was God. And then God is, and then God is love, or something like that. This is way back. And I was too shy, believe it or not, to ask the teacher this question. But one of my classmates was not. He says, I thought we were going to learn to read today, or this first week of school. And I wanted to know that too, because I didn't think this learning to read process would take so long. But it really didn't take very long, because before long, we were reading and absorbing. And the material that I was reading was becoming part of me, for better or for worse. I'd like to say that all my life I've always read the very best and finest and greatest, and that's not true. I've read things that I wish I could erase, that I should never have read. I was talking with somebody lately. Many of us have, I don't know, we call them obsessions. We tend to do things in a way that it's almost compulsory that we do them. I'm a compulsive reader. You have something up here, even if it's in another language, I have to work my way through it and read it. That's just, I have to do that. Others of you, when you see something out of line, you know, the OCD thing, you have to move it so that it lines up with the other three items or something like that. For me, it's reading. I have to read. But that gets me in trouble sometimes, because sometimes there's things that are not fit to read. And when I start, it's very, very hard for me to stop. And we want to read things that have a positive influence and effect on our life. Things that will, you know, we're talking here about having wisdom, cultivating wisdom from writings. I hope you have the right one. I thought it was yellow. Pete, what does it say at the top? You're on it then. Okay, I'll quit worrying about Pete and let him worry about himself for a change. But as people, we should have a yearning, a desire for wisdom. And sometimes there's the temptation to say, well, I don't want to learn too much because then I am responsible for more. So we kind of back off on learning. But we may not learn back off on reading, but we read sometimes things that are pouring the wrong type of material and information into our mind. And time does dull the things that we have read, but we can never really erase that. It's kind of like looking at the wrong pictures, the wrong things. I can't erase those images completely from my mind. Time dulls it, but never completely erases it. And the same thing goes for the things that I read. So we need to be careful that the things that we read is that which brings honor and glory to God and is edifying, builds us up in our day-to-day life. Does that mean that everything we read has to have some Bible moral story, you know, some Bible verse to go with it or something like that? I don't think so. You may disagree with me. That's fine. But it should be something that would not obstruct our way to heaven, but would help us on our way there. And it doesn't always have to be written from exactly my culture or my viewpoint of things. I'm going to read a story here in a little bit. Pete said I was going to lead off with that, but that's not true. We're going to work on some of the things here in your handout first. But it's from a different culture. But I can still learn from that. And I can receive inspiration, knowledge, instruction from the things that I read there. Let's look a little bit at your handout. There at the top, I have that quote by Roy Williams. A smart man makes a mistake, learns from it, and never makes that mistake again. But a wise man finds a smart man and learns from him how to avoid the mistake altogether. So do you want to be smart or wise? You know, learning something from experience has its value. You'll remember it better than just hearing from other people their experience. But do we have enough time in the small lifespan that is ours to experience all the things that can be experienced? No, we do not. So it would be better to learn from other people's experience. And it always saddens me when I see people making mistakes that if they had just asked, or they had the opportunity to read good literature that would have explained to them how to take care of this situation, and they are blind to that and just blindly go on in their path, in their way, stumbling along, trying to learn from their experiences and experiencing things that are terrible because they won't learn from someone else. And to me, again, that is some of the beauty in having good literature and being able to read for ourselves and to hear it read, that it can build me up and can save me from making mistakes that other people have made. In the title of this talk, it says cultivating. And I don't know how they do it as much around here, but in our community, well, we do a lot of spraying for weeds, but we used to do a lot more of the cultivating. We'd drag this tool down through the field, and it got rid of a lot of the weeds. But it also helped to keep the corn roots covered, and they stayed moist longer, and helped strengthen the stalk. I mean, there were so many things that cultivating did. It was a good time to apply some fertilizer and things like that. Do the things that you read have that kind of a positive influence on you and your life? We won't go to the scripture passage that is there. We'll go on down there to where it says, effective reading begins with what? And it begins with the mechanics. And that's what first grade's all about, is learning how to put sounds together, learning sounds and how the sounds go together and how they become words. And at first, that reading, and by that small child, or maybe as an adult that's just learning to read, is very halting and it's painful almost to listen to them. But it begins to smooth out, and the memory starts taking over, and it no longer becomes a phonics exercise where they're sounding out a word sound by sound, but it becomes a memory exercise where they see this word and they recognize it and they can read it with confidence. But it doesn't help to be able to read something if you don't comprehend it. I'm getting better at helping with your German songs. Still don't know what I'm saying, but I'm kind of catching on a little bit to how to say the different sounds and all. And if I understand the tune, I try to go along with your singing when you're singing in German, or if you was doing it in Spanish. But I really don't comprehend it. It has no effect on my being outside of the fact that I recognize the tune, and I may be thinking about words in English that I know that go with that. See, I need comprehension. I need the ability to understand what a writing says if it's going to have any effect on me. So effective reading begins with what? Mechanics and comprehension. But it moves on to so what? You ever heard somebody say that? You tell them something, they say, so what? You know, what about it? How does this affect me? How does this change my life? What does it have to do with me? And that's part of our job as teachers as well, is to teach them that the literature that they read needs to be applied to their everyday life. How can you take this story and think it through and decide how it will affect me? How can I use it in my everyday life? How are the things that are happening in my life a parallel or comparable to the things that I read about in this story? And then it culminates or finishes. The high point comes to, now what? And that's usually what happens. If a person has gotten to what, and they say, oh, this is how to do it, then they say, so what? And then they find out that it applies to their life. Then the question that is asked of each one of us, after we have become more accountable by hearing or reading, whatever, then now what? What am I going to do with this information? How am I going to respond to this? Am I going to be like the foolish man that just goes ahead and builds his house on the sand, even though I know better? Or will I dig deep, lay a solid foundation, and have an enjoyable life because my house is built on a solid rock? Analysis is how writing affects you. Those of you that have been in one of my teacher training classes about first grade have heard me talk about this some, probably. Have you ever read something that made you cry? It's all right, guys. You can nod your head. Yeah, I have. Have you ever read something that made you laugh out loud? Even when you weren't sure, even when you didn't realize that other people were in the room because you were so caught up in your reading and you were reading away, and all of a sudden it's so funny, you just laugh out loud and the room gets quiet and you, ooh. You were analyzing what you were reading and it was gripping you. You know, I've wiped tears off my face too. So one way or the other, I'm analyzing that reading and it is gripping me and it's moving me emotionally. And that's not good. That's not enough, but that's part of the process. Because I can be as emotional as I want to be, but if I walk away from that situation and it hasn't changed me and it hasn't strengthened me or caused me to consider my life and make choices and decisions that are a little more firm, a little more steadfast, maybe change me completely to where I turn around and go in a different direction, then that emotion really hasn't done me any good. So when you analyze your reading, allow yourself to ask yourself some hard questions. How does this apply to my heart and life? That's where wisdom will start to grow, or that's when wisdom will start to grow in your life, in your heart. When the things that you read, the things that you hear, see, we're talking about writings here, but this applies to sermon material that you hear or that I study for or something like that. It applies to many areas of our life. As information floods into our mind, it should be that which draws us heavenward, Godward, away from the things of the world, and helps us to become more like Christ? Do I ponder what I read? Do I spend time thinking about it? If you read something, okay, those of you that are like me that can't lay down a good book, and you read till 3 o'clock in the morning, what happens next? You flip off the light, you turn over, you go right to sleep, right? I don't. My mind is twirling. I'm thinking about things I've read, and I'm thinking how stupid I am for reading so long. But then I can't go to sleep. My mind is pondering the things I read and either the great decisions that the people in the story made or the dumb decisions they made. And why did they do that? You know, and I'm thinking about that. Finally, I drift off to sleep, but the next day, often, I'll be thinking about it more and more when I can keep my eyes open. Does good literature solicit a response from me? And that's basically what we've been saying here, is that as I read, as I ponder, what's my response? How does it affect me? We're going to have a story at this point. Title of this story, I don't think I'm going to hold it up for the pictures, you're too far away. It's called The Candle in the Window. And it's a Christmas story. And if you come to our community, I'm not sure when, but sometime in December, my family, it's our responsibility to have an evening service at our church. And the adults in my family are going to get up and we're going to read this story to the children. So try to do it. We felt that would work better for getting the different voices than me just doing it by myself. Once upon a time, in a little German village, there lived a cobbler named Gunther. In the windows of his little shop, shoes and boots waited for their owners to claim them. Inside it smelled of shoe wax, and the leather was strewn on and around the cobbler's bench. And on any given day, except Sundays, Gunther would be hard at work, cutting, pounding, and stitching. In all the countryside, there was not a finer cobbler. Today was December 24. Snow had begun to fall, and the wind blew hard. Gunther was bent over his bench when in swept a stately gentleman whom Gunther immediately recognized. "Lord von Schimmel," he said politely as he stood and bowed just a bit. Without a greeting of his own, Lord von Schimmel thrust a pair of boots into Gunther's hands. "I need these for a Christmas Eve ball." Gunther opened his eyes wide. "But Christmas Eve is tonight." "Exactly," said Lord von Schimmel. "I shall need them by 5 o'clock. Gunther turned the shoes over, his eyes taking in each detail. "But, Lord von Schimmel, it's already 1 o'clock, and I see there's a considerable amount."
"I shall expect them to be done by 5 o'clock.
Lord von Schimmel repeated imperiously.
"Good day."
And with that, he swept grandly out the door in the same fashion in which he had entered. Gunther stared after him, then down at the boots in his hand, he shook his head gloomily. Gunther was still staring at the shoes when his cousin Griselda appeared at the door. "What is this? My favorite cousin in the doldrums on Christmas Eve?" she exclaimed as she closed the door behind her. She stooped to place a large package on the floor inside. Just then, from the opposite direction, the housekeeper appeared. The plump little woman cleared her throat.
"Excuse me, I need to know about supper. Will there be anything special, it being Christmas Eve? Perhaps some stollen and a few gingerbread?"
"Nein, nein." Gunther sat down at his bench. "Soup is enough."
"If that's your wish, then." With that, she retreated as fast as her short legs would carry her. "Merry Christmas, Griselda," she called, disappearing toward the kitchen.
"And to you, Frau Dibble,"
Griselda responded warmly before turning back to see Gunther's grim expression.
"Gunther, it's Christmas Eve," she scolded him, then continued sympathetically. "You miss your Hilda and your little Carl, don't you?" Gunther slumped at his bench.
"Yeah, I do. But soon the holidays will be over."
He tapped the boots before him. "Now I have these to repair for Lord von Hoity-Toity by 5 o'clock.
"Oh, dear Gunther," Griselda moved toward him. "It's the day Jesus came to be with us."
She put her hand on his arm. "Do you believe it?" Gunther wrinkled his brow thoughtfully. I suppose.
Ach du lieber, I almost forgot. Griselda ran to pick up the object she had brought. She whisked off its cover to reveal a gingerbread house. Made by the children. Here, she thrust it toward him, and with that she was gone.
Gunther stood in the middle of his shop, holding his gift. Griselda's good cheer made his own sadness seem greater. He looked down at the gift from the children. Now what would I want with a gingerbread house? He muttered. 2 hours later, Gunther was hard at work on Lord von Schlemmel's boots when Frau Dibble entered.
Mr. Gunther, you still want no lunch?
Nein, he said without looking up. My work isn't going well. These must be done by 5 o'clock.
One would think we could have a little more cheer around here on Christmas Eve, grumbled Frau Dibble as she left the room.
Gunther sighed deeply. He was very tired. Perhaps if he rested a few moments, he put his head down in his arms. Suddenly, his shop door jingled. Gunther fought to drag himself from a sleepy stupor.
Oh, my, said a woman's voice. He surely needs us.
He doesn't have any Christmas things, exclaimed a child. And there's nothing pretty in the window, said another.
Raising his head, Gunther rubbed his hands across his eyes.
Good day.
Merry Christmas, responded the woman warmly.
You've brought shoes, he asked, rising from his bench.
No shoes.
Gunther was puzzled.
Then you come for something else?
Oh, yes, definitely for something else, she said, removing her cloak.
She took the children's wraps and laid them across the chair.
This is Greta and Franz, and I'm Carrie, she said, smiling.
Gunther blinked as Carrie walked around inspecting things.
I'm Gunther, and... He paused. I've not seen you before. Where do you live?
He asked. He was slightly embarrassed to realize he was now following her about.
Oh, somewhere on the edge of things, you might say.
Carrie picked up a boot and peered at the window.
I see, said Gunther, although he definitely did not see. The children seemed to be everywhere at once, and he had a feeling he might be losing control of his shop.
Oh, look, Greta,
shrieked Franz, pointing.
A gingerbread house,
cried Greta, running and kneeling before it. Carrie spied a stool.
Ah, children, let's put it right up on this. There.
She cocked her head thoughtfully.
Gunther, don't you have a crochet, a manger scene?
It's up in the attic.
Why is it up there? Piped up Greta.
Gunther blinked. Because Christmas doesn't seem happy anymore.
Oh, said Greta.
Meanwhile, Carrie was again walking about the shop.
Excuse me, Gunther interjected, implying it was time for an explanation.
Yes, of course, replied Carrie. Don't worry, you're not in our way. Children, she announced grandly, run outside and bring the candle in.
She nodded at Gunther. We wanted to look things over first.
Of course, Gunther let as much sarcasm creep into his voice as he dared. He sat down. Things were clearly out of control.
Carrie smiled at him charmingly.
You'll like it very much. I know you will.
The children hurried back in, carrying a large, beautiful candle in a box.
Greta ran to Gunther. Could I sit on your lap?
Well, yeah, I suppose you may, he responded, surprised. Greta settled herself.
Herr Gunther, did you ever have a little girl like me?
Nein, but I had a little boy, about the size of Franz.
What was his name?
Carl, answered Gunther, not sure he wished to continue the conversation.
Greta nodded. And did Carl have a mama?
Franz snorted.
She asked so many questions.
It's all right, Franz, said Carrie, taking the candle from Greta. She knelt before the window, arranging greenery from the box around the candle. It's good to talk about those things.
Gunther looked thoughtful. Her name was Hilda.
And did you love her very much? Asked Greta.
Carl and I both did. Franz came to stand beside Gunther. I suppose they died, and that's what made Christmas not seem happy anymore.
Yeah, Gunther replied softly.
Carrie gave the greenery a last pat and struck a match. The candle glowed with a wondrous light.
There now!
Greta slid off Gunther's lap and ran to the window, shrieking,
It's beautiful!
Gunther stood. It was time to get at the heart of things.
Excuse me, but would you mind telling me why you came here?
Because you needed us. Carrie replied simply.
I see, he said, thinking that no, he did not see. Then may I ask why you put a candle in my window? My shop was perfectly fine without it.
Carrie stepped back and surveyed the candle's glow for a long moment.
Well, it's like this.
There's a beautiful old legend that the Christ child walks about on Christmas Eve seeking to enter the hearts of men, and it's a candle in the window that invites him across the threshold. The children on either side of Gunther tugged at his arms.
Did you hear that story before, Herr Gunther?
Gunther frowned.
Oh, my, cried Carrie, it's time we were going. Children, come.
She scooped up their wraps and started toward the door.
Franz stood his ground. But Carrie, you didn't tell him yet.
Carrie stopped in her tracks. Oh, Mercy, you're so right. And it's the most important thing, too. She walked back to Gunther, sat down and waited for him to sit beside her. Then she put her hand on his arm and leaned toward him. And this is what it is. Dot, dot, dot. Gunther swooshed about in a frenzy. Frau Dibble, he boomed. We need more evergreen bows. His housekeeper appeared with an armload of greenery and a puzzled expression. What's gotten into you? Gunther stopped abruptly. Ach, du lieber, we need stolen cookies. Hurry, they must be done in time. Stolen cookies are already baking. I did them just in case. She started for the kitchen, but stopped. In time for what? In time for my visitor, Gunther replied. What visitor? You have people running in and out of here all the time. Gunther smiled. When my visitor comes, you shall know it, I promise. You've never seen this person? Nein, but surely I will. Frau Dibble stared at the candle in the window. That candle, I've never seen it before. Franz and Greta and Carrie brought it to me. Who are they? I don't really know. Then where are they from? Gunther deposited the last evergreen bow beside the lantern. They live somewhere on the edge of things. Frau Dibble turned toward the kitchen and shook her head, muttering to herself. Go up to the attic and fetch the crochet, Gunther called after her. I already did. It's here in the hall, she said, bringing it to him. Eagerly, Gunther pulled back the flaps of the old dusty box. What could be more appropriate for him to see? The housekeeper cocked her head, listening intently. Do you hear something outside? I'll go and look. Frau Dibble soon reappeared with a frail woman. I found her huddled outside. In one bound, Gunther was beside her. Here, sit, please. The woman sank down gratefully. The candle in the window was so beautiful, or she said, the candle in the window was so beautiful I had to stop and look. Then I felt faint. Frau Dibble patted her shoulder comfortingly. Sit here and rest. The woman watched as Gunther went back to his unpacking. As he unwrapped the figure of an angel, the woman let out a cry of delight. Gunther smiled. Would you like to hold it? Oh, could I? She reached to stroke the wood. When I was a child, we lived next to a church that had figures like this. A while later, afternoon had cast soft shadows into the shop. Gunther looked at the old woman who still held the figurine in her hand. His brow wrinkled in thought. Would you like to take the crochet home with you? Oh, I couldn't. You could if I gave it to you. The woman's lying face crinkled in wonderment. A gift? For me? But why? It looks like you were putting it out for someone special. Gunther was silent for a moment, then said softly, I think he would want you to have it. The old woman clasped the wooden figure to her, and tears coursed down her face. It's the most wonderful gift I've ever had. Gunther smiled as he packed the crochet and sent the woman on her way. Now what else was it that I should be doing, he said. Lord von Schlemmel's shoes, Frau Dibble prompted. Gunther cried out in horror. In all excitement, I forgot. I'll never be able to do them by 5 o'clock. Wait, what am I thinking? Lord von Schlemmel can dance in his stocking feet if need be. Gunther strode about his shop. His face broke into a smile. Why didn't I think of it before? I shall make a pair of shoes for the Christ child. Is there enough time? Abruptly, he clapped his hands. The shoes for Prince Frederick, the very finest pair he'd ever made. He need only make a few more stitches and finish off the lacings. The count would come for them next week. Surely he could make another pair for the little prince by then. He retrieved the small shoes from a car box on a shelf and went to work, breaking out in a joyful, good Christian men rejoice. And we're going to skip some of the story. Another man comes, a poor beggar, trying to get warm, claims he has groceries in his bag and all his sticks that he's collecting for fire. And Gunther feeds him, gives him things to eat, and the man is grateful and eats at the table. But while he's eating, we'll start in again. Shortly there was a commotion outside of the shop. The door flew open and in swept Lord von Schlemmel.
I have come for my boots.
And here they are. Gunther held his breath. The man's eyes widened.
But my dear fellow, you've scarcely done a thing to them.
Something more important came up.
Lord von Schlemmel glared at him. But what do you expect me to do?
Gunther put his arm around Lord von Schlemmel's shoulders and moved him jovially but firmly toward the door.
I expect you to dance in your stocking feet. Perhaps you will start a new style.
And now, good night and Merry Christmas. He closed the door on the confused gentleman. When Gunther returned to the table, the beggar paused in his eating. You're making shoes for someone more important than Lord von whoever? Gunther leaned across the table. I'm waiting for the Christ child. Do you think I've taken leave of my senses? The beggar peered over his cup of milk. You look quite sensible to me. Gunther arose, took a worn Bible from the shelf. He tapped it lovingly. In these pages, I find him, and it comforts me here in my heart. Yeah, even when things seem pretty bad? Gunther was thoughtful. Sometimes I still feel very sad, but maybe not so much as if I didn't read. It helps. The beggar munched slowly. And now you wait for him? If you'll pardon my asking, why do you think he's coming here to you?
Someone came today to tell me so. Gunther glanced at the candle.
The beggar wiped his mouth with his hand and stood up.
I must go. Ah, then here are your boots. Please, you must take them, and I shall help you with your coat.
And Gunther gave him a pair of old boots that he claimed he couldn't get rid of. And gives him another coat, because his is worn out. And then Gunther receives a small girl comes who has no home. She's out in the cold, and he invites her in, feeds her, and his cousin Griselda comes back and decides to take the child home with her. They give her the gingerbread house, and he ends up giving her the fine pair of shoes that he had made for Prince Frederick. And he suddenly realizes that he's given all of his gifts away. But this child's very happy, and she goes home with Griselda. And Gunther falls asleep again. And Carrie and Greta and Franz come back and ask him how his day went. And he said, the Christ child didn't come. He said, I did so many things for him, but he didn't come. And he's a bit discouraged. Why have you returned, he asked. To hear of your Christmas Eve, Gunther, Carrie responded. There's nothing to tell. No one came but my cousin. Carrie leaned forward. No one else? Not the Christ child. Only a sick woman and a street beggar and a homeless child. I see. Did you turn them away? I couldn't turn them away. The beggar needed a coat. And I gave away the crochet and the shoes and... He broke off and stared at Carrie in consternation. Is that why he did not come? Because I gave away all the things that were to be his? Carrie jumped to her feet. Oh, you mustn't think that. She moved to the big Bible, which still lay on the table. Look, Gunther, you must read this. And then they go to the passage where it says, then shall the king say to those on his right hand or his left, come, ye blessed, inherit the kingdom prepared for you. For I was hungry, and you fed me. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in naked, and you clothed me. Gunther looked up, and his eyes brimmed with tears. Those things are what I would have wanted to do for the Lord. If he had come, I would have done so. And then they read on where it says, if inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, ye have done it unto me. Gunther stared from one to the others incredulously. It says that, he said. Carrie pointed to the page. It does. See here? And he understands that as he did those things for those poor people, he was doing it for Christ, that Christ had come to him in the form of others. And they finish with a prayer where they say, Lord Jesus, thou whose birth we celebrate, we have lit our candle in the presence of each other and the holy angels. Kindle in our hearts thy flame of love, that day shall break and shadows flee away. Amen. And when he opens his eyes, Carrie and the children are gone. And he understands that they were angels. Okay, a story like that, it should move us properly. But what are some of the things that, you know, what's the theme there? And as we look at what is happening in that man's life, he's sad. His wife, his child have died. And life looks like a gloomy tunnel that stretches out before him. He's lost his desire to see good in life anymore. And even at a joyous time of year, he is down the dumps. He's dejected. He's out of sorts with what life has given him. And he's weighed down by the responsibilities of his job, things like that. But he allows the possibility, the hope, we'd say the hope of Christmas, to enter into his life, and it changes the way that he responds. And we should be able to look at a story like this and see parallels in our own life. Maybe we haven't lost somebody close to us like he did. But we've all met with rejection and discouraging times. As you teach school, you've watched students do things and make choices and decisions that have made you unhappy and disappointed. And maybe made you feel discouraged with teaching. Don't feel that way. You don't know how many children you are encouraging to do the right thing. But to have that positive impact on others' lives is so important. thinking of it from the significance of teachers. But then as we look more at this story and we realize that we would, if Christ came into our midst, if Christ was here today, if Christ was touching us in person, if he came and sat on this front bench, what would happen? Well, we'd probably all fall on our faces, but we would fall all over ourselves to do all sorts of things for him. And yet, if someone comes into our midst that needs help, we maybe look at the way they're dressed, the way they act, they're from a different culture, and we respond in maybe negative ways. Another thing that I see as I study a story like this is that in the joy of giving, in the joy of sharing what I have with other people, joy comes into my life. Happiness comes. I get to the place where I'm overflowing with the love and joy of God because I'm willing to give of myself to other people. If you and it should cause us to have reflection and think about how that when I just live for myself and I become, my thinking dwells only on me, that I am very unhappy. And I'll try all sorts of things to make myself happy, but it just doesn't work. But then when I reach out to other people and I touch other people's lives, and suddenly it makes a difference. And suddenly I find myself having happiness, even though my life isn't perfect. And there are things about my life that I desperately wish I could change, but I cannot. Just checking my time here. We're just about done. Okay. So as you think about literature that you have read, I just gave you an example of something that I appreciate. It's a children's story, I know that. But I taught first and second grade for 7 years, so that's kind of my wavelength. But what literature has inspired you? And we don't have time to have discussion here. But in ways of knowledge, and that can just be informational literature, maybe your vocation, the thing that you work at, in your day-to-day job, you read articles and literature that has to do with it, and you understand how to do it better. People who dairy farm, I was a dairy farmer at one point. I know about that. There's magazines to help you get better milk production and treat your cows better and things like that. For every area of life, there's some type of literature out there, and it can be knowledge that cultivates wisdom in your life. But I'd like us to think that we can do more reading of things that inspire us, that hold us up to a higher plane, that encourage us to do better. We can always do better, right? Even when we know or feel like we are doing our best, the opportunity is if we cultivate that, we can do a little bit better, a little bit better. Literature is there to warn us. We read stories of people who have failed grievously. They've done terrible things. And we can say, I don't want to go down that path. What were the steps that they went down? I don't want to go there. I want to turn away from that path. Proverbs is full of warning. Proverbs is some great literature. There's lots of warning in the book of Proverbs. Motivated. As I read good literature, I should be motivated to get stuff done. It's somewhat the same as inspired. But it's also not just inspiration where I have a holy feeling in my heart, but I want to get out and really get something done to change my life and maybe the lives of others around me. Depends on what the motivation is. So as you read, be careful what you read. You can cultivate that which is not wisdom with your reading. You can read literature that is wrong. But there's so much good literature out there.
And that's another job of our schools, incidentally, is to train and teach children so that they have a grasp of grammar, language arts, so that maybe someday they'll write. You as a teacher may never write anything, but wouldn't you feel good about reading something 10 years from now that one of your students wrote, a book? Make you feel good. It would motivate you to keep on teaching. But as you read, I just encourage you, think about the content and allow good literature to mold your life and lead you in a way that's truly everlasting truth and peace and joy and happiness with God. May the Lord bless you. Okay, next workshop session starts shortly. So remember where Pete told you to go, and we will meet you there.